Preface. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. I wrote that in 1982 as the beginning of a book with the working title Conscience of an Economic Hitman. The book was dedicated to the presidents of two countries, men who had been my clients, whom I respected and thought of as kindred spirits, Jaime Roldós, president of Ecuador, and Omar Torrijos, president of Panama. Both had just died in fiery crashes. Their deaths were not accidental. They were assassinated because they opposed that fraternity of corporate, government, and banking heads whose goal is global empire. We EHMs failed to bring Roldós and Torrijos around. And the other type of hitmen, the CIA-sanctioned jackals who were always right behind us, stepped in. I was persuaded to stop writing that book. I started it four more times during the next 20 years. On each occasion, my decision to begin again was influenced by current world events. The U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989, the first Gulf War, Somalia, the rise of Osama bin Laden. However, threats or bribes always convinced me to stop. In 2003, the president of a major publishing house that is owned by a powerful international corporation read a draft of what had now become Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He described it as a riveting story that needs to be told. Then he smiled sadly, shook his head, and told me that since the executives at World Headquarters might object, he could not afford to risk publishing it. He advised me to fictionalize it. We could market you in the mold of a novelist like John le Carré or Graham Greene. But this is not fiction. It is the true story of my life. A more courageous publisher, one not owned by an international corporation, has agreed to help me tell it. This story must be told. We live in a time of terrible crisis and tremendous opportunity. The story of this particular economic hitman is the story of how we got to where we are and why we currently face crises that seem insurmountable. This story must be told because only by understanding our past mistakes will we be able to take advantage of future opportunities. Because 9/11 happened, and so did the Second War in Iraq. Because, in addition to the 3,000 people who died on September 11, 2001, at the hands of terrorists, another 24,000 died from hunger and related causes. In fact, 24,000 people die every single day because they are unable to obtain life-sustaining food. Most importantly, this story must be told because today, for the first time in history, one nation has the ability, the money, and the power to change all this. It is the nation where I was born, and the one I served as an EHM, the United States of America. What finally convinced me to ignore the threats and bribes? The short answer is that my only child, Jessica, graduated from college and went out into the world on her own. When I recently told her that I was considering publishing this book and shared my fears with her, she said, "Don't worry, Dad. If they get you, I'll take over where you left off. We need to do this for the grandchildren I hope to give you someday." That is the short answer. The longer version relates to my dedication to the country where I was raised, to my love of the ideals expressed by our founding fathers, to my deep commitment to the American Republic that today promises life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all people everywhere. And to my determination after 9/11 not to sit idly by any longer while EHMs turn that republic into a global empire. That is the skeleton version of the long answer. The flesh and blood are added in the chapters that follow. This is a true story. I lived every minute of it. The sights, the people, the conversations, and the feelings I describe were all a part of my life. It is my personal story, and yet it happened within the larger context of world events that have shaped our history, have brought us to where we are today, and form the foundation of our children's futures. I have made every effort to present these experiences, people, and conversations accurately. Whenever I discuss historical events or recreate conversations with other people, I do so with the help of several tools: published documents, personal records and notes, recollections, my own and those of others who participated, the 5 manuscripts I began previously, and historical accounts by other authors, most notably recently published ones that disclose information that formerly was classified or otherwise unavailable. References are provided in the end notes to allow interested readers to pursue these subjects in more depth. My publisher asked whether we actually referred to ourselves as economic hitmen. I assured him that we did, although usually only by the initials. In fact, one day in 1971, when I began working with my teacher, Claudine, she informed me, "My assignment is to mold you into an economic hitman. No one can know about your involvement, not even your wife." Then she turned serious. "Once you're in for life." After that, she seldom used the full name. We were simply EHMs. Claudine's role is a fascinating example of the manipulation that underlies the business I had entered. Beautiful and intelligent, she was highly effective. She understood my weaknesses and used them to her greatest advantage. Her job and the way she executed it exemplify the subtlety of the people behind this system. Claudine pulled no punches when describing what I would be called upon to do. My job, she said, was to encourage world leaders to become part of a vast network that promotes U.S. commercial interests. In the end, those leaders become ensnared in a web of debt that ensures their loyalty. We can draw on them whenever we desire to satisfy our political, economic, or military needs. In turn, they bolster their political positions by bringing industrial parks, power plants, and airports to their people. The owners of U.S. engineering construction companies become fabulously wealthy. Today, we see the results of this system run amok. Executives at our most respected companies hire people at near slave wages to toil under inhuman conditions in Asian sweatshops. Oil companies wantonly pump toxins into rainforest rivers, consciously killing people, animals, and plants, and committing genocide among ancient cultures. The pharmaceutical industry denies life-saving medicines to millions of HIV-infected Africans. 12 million families in our own United States worry about their next meal. The energy industry creates an Enron. The accounting industry creates an Anderson. The income ratio of the 1/5 of the world's population in the wealthiest countries to the 1/5 in the poorest went from 30-1 in 1960 to 74-1 in 1995. The United States spends over $87 billion conducting a war in Iraq, while the United Nations estimates that for less than half that amount, we could provide clean water, adequate diets, sanitation services, and basic education to every person on the planet. And we wonder why terrorists attack us? Some would blame our current problems on an organized conspiracy. I wish it were so simple. Members of a conspiracy can be rooted out and brought to justice. This system, however, is fueled by something far more dangerous than conspiracy. It is driven not by a small band of men, but by a concept that has become accepted as gospel, the idea that all economic growth benefits humankind, and that the greater the growth, the more widespread the benefits. This belief also has a corollary, that those people who excel at stoking the fires of economic growth should be exalted and rewarded, while those born at the fringes are available for exploitation. The concept is, of course, erroneous. We know that in many countries, economic growth benefits only a small portion of the population, and may in fact result in increasingly desperate circumstances for the majority. This effect is reinforced by the corollary belief that the captains of industry who drive this system should enjoy a special status, a belief that is the root of many of our current problems, and is perhaps also the reason why conspiracy theories abound. When men and women are rewarded for greed, greed becomes a corrupting motivator. When we equate the gluttonous consumption of the earth's resources with a status approaching sainthood, when we teach our children to emulate people who live unbalanced lives, and when we define huge sections of the population as subservient to an elite minority, we ask for trouble. And we get it. In their drive to advance the global empire, corporations, banks, and governments, collectively the corporatocracy, use their financial and political muscle to ensure that our schools, businesses, and media support both the fallacious concept and its corollary. They have brought us to a point where our global culture is a monstrous machine that requires exponentially increasing amounts of fuel and maintenance, so much so that in the end, it will have consumed everything in sight and will be left with no choice but to devour itself. The corporatocracy is not a conspiracy, but its members do endorse common values and goals. One of corporatocracy's most important functions is to perpetuate and continually expand and strengthen the system. The lives of those who make it and their accoutrements, their mansions, yachts, and private jets, are presented as models to inspire us all to consume, consume, consume. Every opportunity is taken to convince us that purchasing things is our civic duty, that pillaging the earth is good for the economy, and therefore serves our higher interests. People like me are paid outrageously high salaries to do the system's bidding. If we falter, a more malicious form of hitman, the jackal, steps to the plate. And if the jackal fails, then the job falls to the military. This book is the confession of a man who, back when I was an EHM, was part of a relatively small group. People who play similar roles are more abundant now. They have more euphemistic titles, and they walk the corridors of Monsanto, General Electric, Nike, General Motors, Walmart, and nearly every other major corporation in the world. In a very real sense, Confessions of an Economic Hitman is their story as well as mine. It is your story, too, the story of your world and mine, of the first truly global empire. History tells us that unless we modify this story, it is guaranteed to end tragically. Empires never last. Every one of them has failed terribly. They destroy many cultures as they race toward greater domination, and then they themselves fall. No country or combination of countries can thrive in the long term by exploiting others. This book was written so that we may take heed and remold our story. I am certain that when enough of us become aware of how we are being exploited by the economic engine that creates an insatiable appetite for the world's resources and results in systems that foster slavery, we will no longer tolerate it. We will reassess our role in a world where a few swim in riches and the majority drown in poverty, pollution, and violence. We will commit ourselves to navigating a course toward compassion, democracy, and social justice for all. Admitting to a problem is the first step toward finding a solution. Confessing a sin is the beginning of redemption. Let this book, then, be the start of our salvation. Let it inspire us to new levels of dedication and drive us to realize our dream of balanced and honorable societies. Without the many people whose lives I shared and who are described in the following pages, this book would not have been written. I am grateful for the experiences and the lessons. Beyond them, I thank the people who encouraged me to go out on a limb and tell my story. Stefan Ruckshoffen, Bill and Lynn Twist, Anne Kemp, Art Raffi, so many of the people who participated in Dream Change trips and workshops, especially my co-facilitators Eve Bruce, Lynn Roberts-Herrick, and Mary Tendall, and my incredible wife and partner of 25 years, Winifred, and our daughter Jessica. I am grateful to the many men and women who provided personal insights and information about the multinational banks, international corporations, and political innuendos of various countries, with special thanks to Michael Benelli, Sabrina Bologna, Juan Gabriel Carrasco, Jamie Grant, Paul Shaw, and several others who wish to remain anonymous, but who know who you are. Once the manuscript was written, Barrett Kohler founder Stephen Piersanti not only had the courage to take me in, but also devoted endless hours as a brilliant editor, helping me to frame and reframe the book. My deepest thanks go to Stephen, to Richard Pearl, who introduced me to him, and also to Nova Brown, Randy Fiat, Alan Jones, Chris Lee, Jennifer Liss, Lori Pelashude, and Jenny Williams, who read and critiqued the manuscript. To David Corton, who not only read and critiqued it, but also made me jump through hoops to satisfy his high and excellent standards. To Paul Fedorko, my agent, to Valerie Brewster for crafting the book design, and to Todd Manza, my copy editor, a wordsmith and philosopher extraordinaire. A special word of gratitude to Jeevan Sivasubramanian, Barrett Kohler's managing editor, and to Ken Lupoff, Rick Wilson, Maria Jesus Aguilo, Pat Anderson, Marina Cook, Michael Crowley, Robin Donovan, Kristen France, Tiffany Lee, Katrine Longgren, Diane Plattner, all the BK staff who recognize the need to raise consciousness and who work tirelessly to make this world a better place. I must thank all those men and women who worked with me at Maine and were unaware of the roles they played in helping EHM shape the global empire. I especially thank the ones who worked for me and with whom I traveled to distant lands and shared so many precious moments. Also, Ehud Sperling and his staff at Inner Traditions International, publisher of my earlier books on indigenous cultures and shamanism, and good friends who set me on this path as an author. I am eternally grateful to the men and women who took me into their homes in the jungles, deserts, and mountains, in the cardboard shacks along the canals of Jakarta, and in the slums of countless cities around the world, who shared their food and their lives with me, and who have been my greatest source of inspiration. John Perkins, August 2004.